Good morning. Why don't we invite God's grace and wisdom? Dear Lord, we welcome your wisdom and your grace. Grant us ears to hear. Amen. So, morals, what are they? Morals are standards about right and wrong behavior. And we all like high moral standards. We aspire, right, to high moral standards, and we respect people who take the high moral ground. Or we say we do. When we dive into discussions of morality, it's a little hard, I think we could admit. Hard because, let's be honest, none of us get it right all the time, but none of us like to be wrong. And none of us like to focus on our propensity to fall short. I was once on a bus trip with some people, and it was time to stop for lunch. And when you're on a trip with that many people, as you know, there's no single eatery that appeals to everybody. So you split up. So my friend wanted to go to one place, but his son, his elementary school age son, Curtis, wanted to go somewhere else, wanted to go across the street to the fast food place with the Playland. That's where I wanted to go too, Playland. So I told my friend that I would watch his son, Curtis, there so he could go. So I enjoyed the greasy fast food. Of course, I was a grown up. I ate more slowly. Curtis ate quick. He was in the Playland immediately. When it was time to go, I went to retrieve Curtis. It was one of those Playlands with the ball pits. In my own defense, it is hard to keep track of kids in those things. They disappear, surface, and every once in a while. So I couldn't find him. Couldn't find Curtis. So unbeknownst to me, he had already gone back to be with his dad. So Curtis was fine. But I didn't know that. So I start calling. I start calling for Curtis in my normal voice, which admittedly is deep and loud and perhaps sounds a little authoritarian. I called, "Curtis!" Immediately, a little boy pops up from the ball pit and says, "He didn't do nothing wrong." So I thought, strange kid, who was not Curtis. So I called again. I said, "Curtis!" And again, "He didn't do nothing wrong." Just pops up again. And this happened another time. I looked at the young stranger, and I asked, "Is your name Curtis?" "No." "Do you know Curtis?" "No." "He didn't do nothing wrong." And there it is. I mean, people morally fail all the time, yet we are profoundly uncomfortable with even a vocal inflection that suggests that someone has been caught in the wrong. You know that you fail, and I know, I mean, you know that I fail, and I know that I fail, hopefully, but you do at least. We know we have room to grow, but in the moment, we find moral improvement, and the idea probably fairly discomforting. At least this kid was defending somebody else. Most of us would rather say, "I didn't do nothing wrong," or even, "It was them." Or just glad that the attention, look over there, so my moral need is not in the spotlight. I just admit, a sermon like this that's engaging this fun topic of behaviors, all of us are different, and we need probably at least a dozen different sermons depending on who you are. So I hope you pick and choose the words that I'm speaking. Some of us, we don't say, "I didn't do nothing wrong." We don't say, "It was them," and point over there. Some of us just beat ourselves up, and there's no possibility for transformation because we're just so hard on ourselves. So that's a whole other thing. I hope in the midst of that, we can hear that this is an invitation from God to something that is vibrant and alive. But just acknowledging, we bring this discomfort around morality, to a sermon about right and wrong behavior, but we also bring it to the Bible. So the Bible is not really a book of moral codes. There are sacred texts in the world that really are just lists of right and wrong. The Bible, not so much. Now, I'm sure there are, we know folks who would claim otherwise, who would say, no, the Bible is just this list of long commandments. But I think when we actually open the Bible, what we encounter is that it is a storybook. It is a book of stories. It's a book about people, about their interactions, about their failures, about sometimes even their victories. And I believe that God's hand is in that method, that pedagogical method, if you will. Perhaps God understands how moral learning works and knows that a story is a better teacher of morals than a list of rules is. But there are some places in Scripture that really are just this sort of list of these sections about moral do's and don'ts, in a sense, about right and wrong behaviors, about values, the underlying values that influence these behaviors. The Ten Commandments, of course, are probably already come to mind. You shall not have strange gods, no images. Take that, Snapchat. No misusing of God's name. Remember the Sabbath, honor your father and mother. You shall not murder, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not steal. Don't give false testimony, don't covet. You've probably heard these before. You might even have them memorized better than I just did. You can find them in Exodus 20 as one place where they are if you want to look. And in the New Testament, there's also some similar things. In some of the epistles, letters, there's some lists. But one of the longest of these is here in Matthew, in the Gospel of Matthew, chapters 5, 6, and 7. It's typically called the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus preached it. And today we're looking at part of that, the beginning part of that sermon. Jesus talks about murder and insult and animosity and accusation and reconciliation and adultery and divorce and truth-telling. These are all good things to hear about. But I wonder how you feel when people preach to you about morality and about what you ought to do and what you ought not to do. Thankfully, this is Jesus. Most of us are willing to accept a good moral sermon from Jesus because we're in good hands with Jesus. At the same time, I just think it is good to acknowledge that it is hard to talk about right and wrong. It can kind of feel like walking on eggshells, afraid of where you'll step. But let's try anyway, yeah? When you hear an ought or an ought not, is there a little cringe inside? I mean, so am I right in thinking that? If there is, you're in good company. Let's try to face that cringe together. I had an English teacher in eighth grade and again in high school who was legendary in her strictness and in her sternness, both in matters of English grammar and in life. She would use the word daren't, like dare not, but a contraction, daren't. You daren't miss the comma before the conjunction. You daren't turn this assignment in late. You daren't run in the halls. The last time she caught me running in the halls, I was a mid-20s teacher in that same school, teaching the class that she used to teach to me, and I was late for something, and she was retired, but I don't know where she came from. That has nothing to do with this. Sorry, but anyways, point is, daren't does that cringe thing for me. It kind of spoiled the word for me. Thankfully, no one ever uses it, but it's there. And when we cringe inside to the darents and the oughts and the ought-nots, I think it is easy to have some different reactions, particularly one of two different reactions. We might, on the one hand, want to soften the moral message because of that cringe inside. Let's soften the moral message. Or we might, in a similar way, deflect it. Away from us, because these things are profoundly uncomfortable. But let's acknowledge some of these reactions. So that first reaction of, are you ever tempted to soften a moral message, even one coming from Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount? What would softening the message look like in this case? Well, let's look at the first part of the passage. You're welcome to turn there or just to listen. Matthew 5, 21 through 26. You've heard that it was said to those of ancient times, you shall not murder, and whoever murders shall be liable to judgment. But I say to you that if you are angry with a brother or sister, you will be liable to judgment. And if you insult a brother or sister, you will be liable to the council. And if you say, you fool, you will be liable to the hell of fire. So when you are offering your gift at the altar, if you remember that your brother or sister is something against you, leave your gift there before the altar and go. First be reconciled to your brother or sister and then come and offer your gift. Come to terms quickly with your accuser while you are on the way to the court with him or your accuser. May hand you over to the judge and the judge to the guard, and you will be thrown into prison. Truly, I tell you, you'll never get out until you have paid the last penny. What would that look? Are you ever tempted to soften a moral teaching such as this one? There are various ways we have of doing this. We might try to explain it away. I mean, Jesus couldn't really mean don't harbor anger against others. We'd all be guilty then, wouldn't we? Well, yeah, we might. And why should that surprise us? Why should we be wary of admitting that we all do and sometimes do fail? Other ways of softening the message. I think most often for me, I soften the message, not by explaining it away, but just by simply ignoring, just moving on to a different passage of Scripture or to something else entirely. Like, I know I'm angry at people. I've called people names. I don't like feeling bad, so let's just move on. Set the book down and go about my day. Or here's another way to soften a moral message. I might soften by being actually ridiculously strict about the message. Well, I'm okay because I don't call people fools. I don't call people that. I just call them not very smart. Oh, that annoying customer of mine, they are so not very smart. See, I'm okay. I didn't say fool. So what if we monitored that sort of inner reaction to a moral message, and instead of explaining away, instead of ignoring, or distorting the message and twisting it in some way, what if we open ourselves to change? I had this moment a couple Sundays ago where Joshua was preaching about, I forget the exact words that he used, but, you know, about how we think of others and how we get in our own camps and exclude others and things like that. It was one of those sermons where I was like nodding along, like, oh yeah, this is good stuff. I'm glad people are hearing this. And then it morphed into like, I need to change. Like this, it was sort of like, I don't want to say ouch because it wasn't like a wound. It was like, but it was sort of like, oh, this is like it was a welcome discomfort and a necessary one, but it was like, oh, I have homework to do. What if we open ourselves to change? What if we try to discover the truth about ourselves? We might discover an opportunity to raise the bar on life. Which makes me want to jump to the end of our passage today, because that's about truth-telling. It kind of fits with some of these verses that start in chapter 5, verse 37. Why don't we diverge there and look a little bit there. I'm just going to read starting in verse 33. Again, you've heard that it was said to those of ancient times, you shall not swear falsely, but carry out the vows you have made to the Lord. But I say to you, don't swear at all, either by heaven, for that's the throne of God, or by the earth, for that is God's footstool, or by Jerusalem, for that's the city of the great king. And do not swear by your head, for you cannot make one hair white or black. Let me tell you, that is true. Let your word be yes, yes, or no, no. Anything more than this comes from the evil one. It's a probably familiar passage to you. It's sort of pleasant in its, let's just boil it down and just be simple truth tellers. The invitation here is to not swerve from the truth, and it's a necessary invitation because if we're honest with each other, when I lie, it's not often that I'm deliberately lying to someone else. It's that I've first lied to myself and believe that what I'm telling myself is true. So it's helpful to have this invitation to not swerve from the truth. The oaths or swearing that Jesus is referring to here is not what we think of as bad language. I mean, swearing in English can sometimes mean that. If you have a potty mouth, that might be a problem. It's just not what Jesus is talking about here. This is referring to adding force to your statements in an effort to impress others or yourself with your claims to truth, usually because people might otherwise doubt you if you don't add this extra So, or maybe because deep down you doubt yourself. We even do this sometimes in court, or still elected officials are often sworn in on a Bible. It is as though we are saying, the rest of my life is untrustworthy, but if I swear on this book that I may have never read, then you can believe me. The funny thing is, right, that if that is truly the case, if you are only trustworthy when you swear on the Bible, or if you, we used to say when we were kids, promise and cross my heart and hope to die, if that's necessary, if that's the case, then why should we believe you ever? Jesus' invitation is just to live life and speak life truthfully, to say what we mean and mean what we say. Credit to Horton the Elephant for that one. There's no embellishment. What if we lived in a way that no embellishment to our words and life was needed, that people will trust us? Back to softening moral messages. Can we admit that we are often tempted to lie, and that we often lie to ourselves when it comes to our moral weaknesses and failures? That line of Jesus is one that I think I'm wanting to take seriously. The line that says, if you say, you fool. And this is in a passage about murder. Let's keep that in mind. I haven't killed anybody. And then Jesus is like, well, have you called someone a fool? Interesting. Jesus says, you fool, if you say you fool, you'll be liable to the hell of fire. This idea that calling someone a fool is actually a choice to push God away, to a choice to estrange ourselves from God, to cut ourselves off from God. I've been noticing that when someone is bothering me significantly, especially if I think they think ill of me or think ill of my ideas or my people, I defend myself by questioning their mental ability. And here's the line I use, and you can ask Beth, she's definitely heard me use this. I say, you know, they are just not the sharpest tool in the shed. That's my line. I don't know what yours is, but like I'm as I was reading this passage, I'm like, you know, I've been saying that a lot to myself and, well, out loud, obviously. I have to admit that it makes me feel better for a short moment. I mean, I have it together. It's that person over there who doesn't have their wits about them. Could it be that, I mean, is Jesus saying that by doing that, I might be pushing God away? In this day and age, maybe that's a message we need to hear. Put a different way, in a more positive way, if I move towards relationship, rather than writing someone off as a dimwit, but if I move towards them, am I perhaps actually welcoming God into my life, into theirs, into our relationship? I feel like this is the stuff. This is the good hard work of the Sermon on the Mount. It's giving us this raising of the bar on life, moving towards relationship with others and God. Be reconciled rather than let human animosity run its course. There that is that Jesus leaves us to chew on. Instead of softening the moral message, could we dig into this truth about ourselves and welcome God into our relationships? So there's another reaction to moral messages that I find frequent, and that is instead of softening or ignoring the message, when we hear the oughts, the ought-nots, the darents, we get uncomfortable and we deflect them to others. When we imagine God glaring at us, we point a finger, it was them! It was them over there! Those sinners over there. I thought of this morning, the Jesus Messiah song. Jesus Messiah? Yeah, that. I don't know where, but there, someone had mistyped a slide, not in this congregation, but I was somewhere, rescue from sinners was how it was printed. You know, not rescue for sinners, but rescue from sinners. And it stuck with me because I'm like, this is too much. We church people have done that very thing. Like, we are like, let's be rescued from sinners. That's not the message of the Bible. Quite the opposite, actually. You realize you are one, and that you're surrounded by them. But praise be to God that God's stronger and loving. Anyways, that was not in my notes. I shouldn't depart. But anyway, instead of softening or mooring, so we want to point the finger. It was them. By the way, I was just saying, sometimes it's when we imagine God glaring at us that we want to point the finger so that our moral failures aren't in the limelight. Just an aside, maybe we shouldn't trivialize God's massive work of healing and love, healing for the universe. I mean, that's God's project. Maybe we shouldn't trivialize that by imagining that God spends the days glaring at us. The stories that we have and the experiences we have of this God revealed by Jesus show a God who is involved with hearts and with heart and hands out of deep love and a deep vision for humanity, not whiling the time away, wagging a finger at us. Maybe God's not wasting time disapproving of everyone, and maybe we don't have to either. Just a thought. So this whole finger-pointing thing seems ripe for some lighthearted topics here in this sermon, adultery and divorce. It's probably not a coincidence that these two are addressed in close proximity. Sometimes there's overlap between these troubles. I do think that having a moral conversation about adultery and divorce highlights this human propensity to point fingers. For hundreds of years, maybe thousands, this part of the Sermon on the Mount has been twisted and wielded to attach scarlet letters to people, to socially banish or diminish some folks to the outskirts of society, or at least the outskirts of church. But the point of this part of the Sermon on the Mount, it seems to be what Jesus is saying, isn't to stratify, to make good kids and bad kids in church. You know, it's not to create layers of social acceptability with the elite who are behaving themselves and the failures who haven't. It's quite the opposite. Jesus takes a sin, if you will, that has resulted in ostracization, marginalization, and turns it upside down. Says adultery, yeah. Well, that's bad. But do you look with lust? So instead of pointing the fingers, ask this very common a question about a very common thing. But we say those adulterers over there, those unfaithful philanderers. I just wanted to say philanderers in a sermon. And Jesus is coming back, as he does elsewhere in the Gospels, such as John chapter 9, chapter 8. Do you really have a stone to throw? Do you really have a stone to throw, Jesus seems to be saying here. You who have likely craved another, you have also been unfaithful. It's not just those people over there. Jesus is clearly not trying to make adultery normal or justify it in any way. In fact, his imagery here is very stark, right? The cut off the parts of you that are, you know, that lust is such a powerful and corrupting force that if there is something causing it in your life, cut it off. Close that avenue. If there's a place and time, for instance, when pornography is coming too easily to you, change the venue or change the schedule. If there is the wrong kind of relationship that is blooming, leave it alone. Find a way to taper that off. If you are distracted by what your spouse isn't, spend more time thanking God for who your spouse is. If your dating practices, this isn't just about married people, if your dating practices are superficial, maybe give up dating for a time and enjoy your friends. I still think I learned more about human relationships and even more about marriage from my male roommates than I ever did from dating. Apologies to anyone I ever dated, including Beth. I mean, it's just you learn a lot more from just genuine human interactions, but that's a rabbit trail. All of our situations are different, and they require different kinds of creative faithfulness. Yes? So Jesus' stark language is there, not trying to excuse it. So there's an invitation here to be creatively faithful, to ask ourselves how we can be more faithful in our relationship. But there is no room to throw stones. There is no room to throw stones. Divorce is also an example of that, isn't it? We love to lament divorce, don't we? How many times have I heard, did you know that 50% of all marriages end in divorce and that statistic is true among Christians? Oh, the travesty. There is plenty of room for lament, and that is something that should be lamented. That there's, isn't there more room for companionship? To be with a friend, to express empathy rather than shock if they are facing or have faced divorce. The funny thing about pointing fingers when it comes to divorce, and I suspect those of you who have been through divorce can vouch for this, those who have faced divorce already know better than anyone else how awful it is. And what good does it do to point fingers in shock? There are no winners. It is a lament-worthy situation, and I would hope a companionship-worthy situation. The focus Jesus offers here is not to accuse, not to gloat or to gossip. The focus is to look at ourselves and our propensity to treat others in a way that breaks relationships. Jesus is promoting God's desire to heal relationships and to love people. And this, all of this, no matter what the topic is, the divorce or murder or anything, it goes without saying, but it probably needs to be said anyway, there is no mistake that you have made that is beyond the healing of God. I didn't make that up. That's the message of the scriptures. There is no mistake that you have made that goes beyond the healing of God. God forgives. Our mistakes do not have the last word. The last word, we hear in one of the last words of Jesus Christ on the cross, Father, forgive them. If your choices or the choices of others in your life that have negatively impacted you, if they've left you broken, you are not beyond repair. You are definitely not beyond repair. I am not beyond repair to a creative and steadfastly loving God. So adultery, this is probably cliche, but whenever I think of adultery and lust, I don't think that's terribly often, thankfully, but whenever I think of adultery and lust, I think of these goats we used to live with, Beth and I. They lived outside, not in the house. They were neighbor goats, I guess, neighbor goats. They lived in this large and verdant pasture, these goats. But they would stick their heads through the fence and eat our lawn. I know that's a cliche. It's where we get the phrase, the grass is greener on the other side of the fence. Humans, like goats, will embrace discontentment even in the midst of rich abundance, right? Have I taken the time lately to thank God for the pastures I am in rather than what is perceived on the other side of the fence? You can tell Beth I just compared her to grass. She might take it as a compliment, having grown up on a farm. Do we take the time to thank God for the people we are with, the person we are with, faults and all? And just another aside about the divorce and adultery piece here, but it seems like a worthy aside. So Jesus is always talking to everybody, generally speaking. So when, and this message certainly applies to women, there's no denying that, but did you notice that Jesus is like singling out men, like speaking in a way that is just focused on men? In a male-dominated society, maybe that Jesus was in, maybe even more male-dominated than ours is today, Jesus is reminding men to treat women with respect and equality, to treat relationships with women as sacred, to not pay attention to laws and cultural norms that reduce or take power from women. It's right there. It's in the Sermon on the Mount. Speaking specifically to men seems like it'd be worth noting. Well, murder, accusation, sex, and lies. I think we've about covered it today. If you still feel squeamish with all the oughts and the ought-nots, that's quite understandable. Maybe we're best left today with this moral wisdom from God from Deuteronomy chapter 30. I'm just going to read verses 15 and 16. See, I have set before you today life and prosperity, death and adversity. If you obey the commandments of the Lord your God that I am commanding you today, by loving the Lord your God, walking in his ways, and observing his commandments, decrees, and ordinances, then you shall live and become numerous, and the Lord your God will bless you. We do have choices in life, don't we? And thanks to God, life is among those choices. Courage and strength to you this week as you live the life God has given.